Well, you know, there are few things in life that are more certain than change. Now, I'm not talking about the coins in your pocket. I'm talking about alteration in your normal routine, additional responsibilities or the removal of responsibilities, changes in your health, changes in your appearance, changes in just about anything and everything. Is there anything in life that never changes? Well, that's kind of a mystery. I guess it depends on your perspective. Now, the thing about Jesus Christ, he's the same yesterday, today, and forever. Now, if you and I look in the mirror, you realize very quickly that you do not share that quality with Jesus Christ, and neither do I. Especially if you look in the mirror and then check out some pictures of you 30 or 40 years ago, and then you will ask yourself a couple of questions. Who is that person in that picture, number one? And number two, did I ever look that young? And when you get to be a certain age, you really begin to accept that change is inevitable, no matter what you try to do to stop the sags or the loss or whatever, it just seems to continue. So from subtle and almost imperceptible changes to sudden and transformative changes, change happens to us all. It may very well be the most consistent factor in your life, but we don't always focus on it. We don't want to focus on it in most cases. Because above all, we like consistency. We like everything to remain the same, right? A constant. If you take the same route to work every week, every week, every week, and suddenly a detour comes up. Now, I have to go around here and turn there. It lasts for only a week, but your ire over it lasts for 2 weeks because your routine was interrupted. And if you don't think you're sensitive to change and change doesn't bother you, just try this one time. You probably put your pants on one leg at a time, just like everybody else. Well, you probably put your pants on with the same leg first every time you do it. So the next time you put your pants on, of course privately, I want this done privately, go with the opposite leg and just see what change does to you. Now, maybe you better have 911 handy and somebody to hold you and support you. You might go down. You might go down. But even something as subtle as that, we get into habits, we get comfortable, it's consistent. We don't want to change things. We'd rather not. But you know something? We don't always have the choice, do we? Because change comes, in many cases, whether we like it or not. And there are some times in our lives when everything seems to be stable and normal and nothing is really changing. And we're on a steady keel, we're making progress, everything is fine, and then suddenly, whammo, something hits, something changes, something affects us, and we kind of look around and wonder what happened. And for the most part, I think we are often resistant to change because it's unsettling. It's the unexpected. It's the unknown. It's the out of the ordinary. And it's difficult to adjust at times. And why should we get excited about exchanging what we know for what we don't know? From moving to changing jobs, to enduring severe health trials, we will all be forced to confront change and deal with it. Change can be pleasant. Your boss calls you in and says, hey, I'm giving you a raise. Could you think of anything more pleasant than that? Now, if he called you in and said, hey, I'm going to fire you, now that's change too, but you'd rather have the other change. So we have preferences in our changes, but we don't always get to choose which ones we get. As I said, change can be pleasant. It can be miserable. It can be profitable. It can be challenging. discouraging, inspiring, depressing, and at times it can be all of the above, almost instantaneously. You have multiple reactions and responses when change comes. And it's not a matter of if it will come, it's a matter of what, when, and how much, and in what direction. Your life is bound to change, just like mine. How will we deal with it? Can we learn to expect it? That's kind of difficult, isn't it? Can we learn to grow through it? And can we learn to accept it? Expect, grow, and accept. Often difficult. Notice in Ecclesiastes chapter 3, these famous verses. Apparently penned by Solomon and giving us an idea of the times and seasons of our lives. Very familiar verses here. Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes chapter 3. The famous time verses. Verse 3, to everything there is a season, a time for every purpose under heaven. And even in the first lists of the elements of change and the different times and seasons of life, there is a time to be born and a time to die. And from the moment of birth, you and I are progressing to that other time, aren't we? Now, it's a long time initially, but then the time gets shorter and we are moving toward that different time in our life. And it's not always something we dwell on, nor should we necessarily dwell on it. There's a time to plant and a time to pluck what is planted. A time to kill, a time to heal, a time to break down, a time to build up. A time to weep and a time to laugh. Now, most of us would rather laugh our entire lives and not have to weep. But there are times that weeping is appropriate, it's necessary, it happens. There's a time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. So you might say timing is everything in these verses. These are the times of our lives, and all of these times will come. And you'll notice that they are juxtaposed one against the other. They are essentially opposites. So we will run the whole gamut and the whole spectrum through our lives. Change is inevitable. And all of these time scriptures point to the fact that the different times in our lives will require different responses. And really wrapped into all of this is the concept of change. So this morning, I'd like to explore the fascinating subject of change and learn how we can more effectively embrace and accept the changes that are realities in our life, realities that our Creator wove into the fabric of our lives. And in order to learn those lessons, to grow from change, to accept and to expect change, I'd like to turn to some biblical examples this morning to show how several different people adapted to and accepted and dealt with change in their lives. I've got several examples, and I hope that each will illustrate a little bit different aspect of how change affected them and how they responded to it. And I hope that they illustrate for us some very important lessons that we can learn and take away from their experience that will help us deal with the change that is coming. Or, in some cases here in this audience, the change that is already underway. Because dynamics in life are just that, very dynamic. And they do change. It's an inevitable factor in our existence and something I hope that these examples will help us deal with more effectively. Let's begin with John the Baptist. In John chapter 3, John chapter 3, we'll begin at verse 22. Now, John the Baptist, of course, began his ministry before Jesus Christ did. Essentially, the starting point of Christ's ministry was what? The imprisonment of John the Baptist. Now, as you listen to John the Baptist here in these verses, I want you to listen carefully to determine what kind of attitude John had and what was going through his mind and how he was approaching his role and his responsibility as it appeared to him at that moment before Christ began his ministry. And if you recall, this account does not include it, but John actually did what? He baptized Jesus Christ. Baptized Jesus Christ. Now, I've done that a few times, not Jesus Christ, but I baptized a few people. And you have an affinity, you have a closeness to them because you were there at an important time and event in their lives. And many times I've been approached by individuals from 25, 30, 40 years ago who said, well, do you remember me? And I struggle and I say, well, I know I should and all this, you know, have all your answer. Well, yes, I do. Most times I remember them, but I don't remember a lot about them because after hundreds, probably thousands, it's a little difficult to keep track. But they often bring up the fact, well, you baptized me. So John the Baptist baptized Jesus Christ. And he was a voice crying in the wilderness, heralding the arrival of Jesus Christ. People went out in the wilderness to hear him and to see him, and he was quite a sight. He was an unusual person. His diet was not normal. His clothing was not normal. Right? He was unusual. You might even call him a little bit eccentric. But nonetheless, he was a messenger of God, and he accomplished great things in his life. So let's read and keep in mind the context that we're addressing here. Change. And John the Baptist's role is about to change abruptly. He is going to be thrown in prison. His ministry will cease. His disciples will still be out there, active. But Christ is going to begin his ministry. In other words, John the Baptist was really a focal point of what God was doing, the focal point of what God was doing for a very brief time prior to Christ's ministry beginning. But after Christ's ministry began, John the Baptist was in prison. He was very limited. So let's see how John responded and reacted to this change in his life. And I want to read these verses to give you a little bit of background. After these things, verse 22, John 3, Jesus and his disciples came into the land of Judea, and there he remained with them and baptized. Now, you'll note later in John that Christ baptized no one. His disciples did the baptizing. So here was a little different element as well. John was called what? John the Baptist. So here's another religious leader with disciples baptizing. Well, how much do you enjoy competition in your workplace? How much do you like someone doing something that you've always done? Even here in church. What if somebody else made the coffee and you made the coffee for 25 years? Somebody walked in and made the coffee on a Sabbath and didn't ask you about it. Well, how would you feel? Well, you might get a little, the feathers might go up just a little. Now, I've been making coffee for 25 years. You think I can't do it? Who gave you permission to make coffee? I'm not saying this is necessarily an evil response, but it is a human response, isn't it? So if you're baptizing and you're a person of note and you're out in the wilderness and people are coming to see you and they're wanting you to baptize them, and then there's a competing element over here, it might be a little unsettling to you. That's a change. Verse 23, now John was also baptizing in Anon near Salim, because there was much water there. That's because he was doing it by immersion and not with sprinkling. I could baptize 100 people with the water I've got under here if it only required sprinkling. So he was there because there was much water. He had not yet been thrown into prison. Then there arose a dispute between some of John's disciples and the Jews about purification. So there were some religious issues, some doctrinal issues, if you will. And they came to John and said to him, Rabbi, or teacher. So he held a position of respect. Rabbi was a title, if you will. He who was with you beyond the Jordan, to whom you have testified, behold, he is baptizing, and all are coming to him. Well, it seems like things are changing. People are starting to gravitate toward Christ and move away from John the Baptist. Now, what was John's response here? Verse 27. John answered and said, a man can receive nothing unless it has been given to him from heaven. You yourselves bear me witness that I said I am not the Christ, but I have been sent before him. I've been sent to prepare the way. He who has the bride is the bridegroom. But the friend of the bridegroom who stands and hears him rejoices greatly because of the bridegroom's voice. Therefore, this joy of mine is fulfilled. What a marvelous attitude here. And he really brings an excellent metaphor into the discussion, doesn't he? He who has the bride is the bridegroom. And who was that? It was Christ. Christ had the church. Christ was the bridegroom. The church was the bride. Who was John? The best man. He was standing at Christ's side, rejoicing in the fact that Christ was the groom. He knew he wasn't the groom. He was the best man. He was next to him. He wasn't saying, I do. He wasn't the putting the ring on. He was next to him. He was that voice crying in the wilderness, heralding the arrival of someone who is so much greater than he. What did he say? I'm not even worthy to what? Untie his shoe. So he had the right attitude here. He must increase, verse 30. He must increase. I must decrease. Now put yourself in this position. Bring yourself into your workplace if you're working. If you're not working, put yourself into your workplace when you were working. And you were doing a job, you were doing a great job, you had top sales position every month. And this new guy comes in and he's just blowing the top off the charts. And you sit down and tell yourself, well, I must decrease and he must increase. Is that what you said? No, I doubt it. You probably said, I must increase and I must figure out a way, if you're really diabolical, to determine how he could decrease so I can increase. Isn't that what human nature does? We're competitive and we don't like to be challenged and we don't like the change. The alteration in the status quo. Now, probably I'm the only one that thinks like that once in a while. We all know we do. And to encourage someone else to increase while we decrease, well, at the very least, could we not increase together? But we'd still like to be just a smidgen higher. To esteem others better than ourselves, to put ourselves in a lower position, all of those lessons that Christ taught his disciples that we should be implementing in this theater of change, it is difficult in reality to really accomplish this in our lives. Now, verse 31. He who comes from above is above all. He who is of the earth is earthly and speaks of the earth. So he's putting himself in the right position. Earthly as opposed to divine. So he has the right approach here. And I want you now to turn to Luke chapter 7. Luke chapter 7. And I want you to listen to the words of Jesus Christ as he addresses this issue of John the Baptist and the whole milieu of the relationship between himself and John, John's decrease and Christ's increase, the sensitivities that were involved there, the challenges that were involved there, the changes that were evolving in the lives of Christ and his disciples, and the lives of John and his disciples. See, they were all experiencing change, and they all reacted to it in different ways, and we can learn some things from them. Luke 7, let's begin in verse 15. Christ raised the widow's son here back to life. A remarkable miracle. He just came up to the coffin. He touched the open coffin and said, "Young man, I say to you, arise." Can you imagine what would happen if someone had that capability today and that picture were sent round the world instantaneously? What a wave of excitement and awe and amazement would be cast over the entire world as they witnessed a miracle. Of course, there would be skeptics and what have you, but in this day and time, that's one of the elements, I think, prophetically, as an aside, that is going to bring this world to the point that Christ predicted it would come to. When the powers that be under the auspices of Satan begin to have those kinds of dramatic miracles occurring, heavenly signs and calling fire down and doing all kinds of things that are beyond our human ability to accomplish, and that will bring religion to the fore, that will bring the beast and the false prophet together, that will create the scenario that we see outlined in Scripture. I think all of that could happen rather suddenly. But back to our story. Verse 15, so he was that was dead sat up and began to speak to his mother. He began to speak, rather, and he, that is Christ, presented him to his mother. Wouldn't that be an exciting thing to do, to present a mother with her son restored to life? Then fear came upon them all, and they glorified God, saying, "A great prophet has risen up among us, and God has visited his people." He truly has. And this was the message that John came crying and proclaiming. And this report about him went throughout all Judea and all the surrounding region. So the press coverage was far more extensive than John the Baptist had received, if you will. Now, verse 18, it gets interesting. Then the disciples of John reported to him concerning all these things. And apparently, John was in prison at this point. And John, calling two of his disciples to him, sent them to Jesus, saying, "Are you the coming one, or do we look for another?" Now, think about that for a moment. And recall what we read earlier in the book of John. I must decrease, he must increase. This is the one God sent. This is the Messiah. And now he has questions. Now he wonders. His disciples have questions. They wonder. He instructs two of his disciples to go and ask Jesus Christ a rather obvious question, as far as the answer is concerned, we all know the answer, but John wasn't quite sure at this point. Why do you think he wasn't quite sure? Well, he was a human being. Some of his confidence, some of his humility, some of his ability to accept the change in his position and office and authority and influence was affecting him. Obviously, and well, perhaps I should say apparently, to the point where he was now questioning Christ's identity. And maybe he's not the one, maybe we should look for someone else, and maybe I'm going to get out of here and still proclaim the message and still prepare the way for the real Messiah. Maybe he isn't the real one. So doubt entered in. And I don't know all of the emotions or the complex feelings that affected John at this point, but it's clear there's been a shift in his approach. His life was changing. I mean, he's in prison. Somebody else is baptizing. Somebody else is gathering a following. In fact, somebody else has upset the entire country. They're all talking about it. He's resurrected a dead person, brought them back to life. So he's feeling a little uneasy. He's feeling a little left out. He's feeling a little put down. And he wants to rise back up again. He's not quite sure how to do it. And I wonder if he would say to himself again, I must decrease and he must increase. I think he was wanting to increase a little bit here. He needed a boost. Wouldn't you need a boost and a bump if you were in prison? Sure you would. But the point is, how did he adjust to this change? He had his struggles, just like all of us. Verse 20. Now when the men had come to him, that is to Christ, they said, John the Baptist has sent us to you, saying, are you the coming one, or do we look for another? I want you to notice how Christ deals with this question. And of course, at that very hour, he cured many of infirmities, afflictions, and evil spirits, and to many blind he gave sight. You know, a small fraction of the miracles that Christ performed are actually recorded in Scripture. So he is performing dozens of miracles right now. The evidence is obvious. And let's put ourselves in Christ's shoes now, because he's rising in influence. You know, his sales are up. And the other sales are down. This other salesman is suffering. And you could say, if you were carnal and human, well, why do you guys even come here? What do you mean? How dare you question me? You go back and tell John that, of course, I'm the Messiah, and he has to decrease. I'm going to increase. His job is done. Why are you questioning me? Christ said nothing of the kind. In fact, I would essentially call what follows a beautiful eulogy to John the Baptist and Christ's deep love and appreciation for him, for he knew the fate that was going to befall John. So let's read with interest and within this context what Christ said to the disciples of John the Baptist. Verse 22. Go and tell John the things you have seen and heard. Don't tell him what I say. Explain and describe the things that you have seen and that you have heard. That the blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, the poor have the gospel preached to him, or to them rather. The fruit. Christ is pointing to the fruit. He's not berating John or John's disciples. He's trying to encourage them. Look at the fruit. Now, this next sentence is very telling. This gets to the heart and core of the issue. Verse 23, and blessed is he who is not offended because of me. Are you listening, John? When your disciples relay this message, blessed is he who is not offended in me. Don't let Jesus Christ, your Messiah, become a stumbling block. What a gentle reminder, and what mild correction. What a loving thing to say. When the messengers of John had departed, he began to speak to the multitudes concerning John. Now, again, I would describe this as a eulogy of sorts. John is still alive, but Christ knows what's coming. What did you go out into the wilderness to see? A reed shaken by the wind? Because you can imagine John had his detractors. That guy is weird. He dresses in animal skins. He eats locusts and honey. He hangs out by the river. He's not normal at all. He's shouting. He's putting down the Pharisees. He's baptizing people. He's doing all kinds of unusual things. He was quite dynamic. So Christ chided the religious leaders and the people gathered and said, what did you go out in the wilderness to see? A reed blown by the wind? Some indecisive, weak, just kind of a little piece of blade of grass that was easily blown from side to side? Verse 25. But what did you go out to see? He asked the question again. A man clothed in soft garments? Somebody in a business suit? Indeed, those who are gorgeously appareled and live in luxury are in king's courts. But what did you go out to see? So this is the third time he asks the question. He addresses the critics on both sides. And finally, the third comment. Yes, did you go out to see a prophet? Well, that's what you should have gone out to see, because that's what John is. He was not a reed shaken in the wind. He was not a man clothed in soft apparel. He was a prophet. Yes, I say to you, and more than a prophet. This is he of whom it is written, behold, I send my messenger before your face, who will prepare your way before you. Now, a very telling verse here. Christ closes his commentary by stating, for I say to you, among those born of women, and until the test tube came along, I guess that was all of us, wasn't it? And truly, it still is all of us, because the eggs come from somewhere. They can't make those yet. But give them time. Among those born of women, there is not a greater prophet than John the Baptist. And one hopes that somehow word got back to John. You think it did? I think it did. But he who is least in the kingdom of God is greater than he. So another teaching opportunity and moment for Christ, where he illustrated the greatness of John the Baptist and commended him and complimented him and endorsed him as a prophet, in fact, the greatest prophet. There's no greater prophet than John the Baptist. And yet, the lowest in the kingdom, the least in the kingdom, will be greater than John the Baptist. That's how great the kingdom will be, and our existence in the kingdom will be. So what a beautiful way to address someone whose faith was shaken, whose life was changing, and John really had no idea how dramatically his life was going to change. He was going to lose his head. Brought to Herod on a silver charger. Horrible. And so, why did Christ go to a solitary place when he heard that John the Baptist had been murdered? It must have been a very sad time for Christ and for John's disciples. And of course, he even makes other comments about John the Baptist here later, verse 33, and the criticisms that they leveled at John were somewhat the opposite that they leveled at him. The critics always have something to say. Now, let's look at another example. Turn to the book of Ruth, please. You have to be careful because Ruth is a short book. Now, we all know the story. I just want to give a few highlights here. Elimelech and Naomi lived in Bethlehem, Judah. There was a famine in the land. They took their two sons and they moved to the land of Moab to survive the famine. But while in the land of Moab, the two boys married. And sadly, over the years, the two boys died, Elimelech died, and the three ladies were left without their husbands. And of course, Naomi looked at the situation and decided that she would go back to her homeland because she was a foreigner in Moab. She wanted to go back home. So I want to pick up the story here, just read a few verses. As we read in verse 5, then both Mahlon and Chilion died, so the woman survived her two sons and her husband. That's Naomi. Verse 6, then she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had visited his people by giving them bread. The famine was over. She wanted to go back home. Therefore, verse 7, she went out from the place where she was, and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. So as she was departing, Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, and what a loving gesture. I don't know how she was at this time. She must have been up there in years. She was going to be traveling alone because she wanted the two daughters-in-law, what? To stay in the land of Moab, where they belonged, where their heritage was, their gods were, their life was there. And you'll hear her reasoning, and it's a very loving and kind response to her own grief and sorrow at the loss of two sons and a husband. Will that change your life? Oh, you bet. That will be a dramatic shift and change. And now she's going to move, and she's going to leave her two daughters-in-law behind. That's the way life is. Sometimes it all goes along, and then suddenly, boom. So how did Naomi, and more specifically Ruth, react? Well, go return to your mother's house, she said in verse 8. And the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. So God bless you. Go back to your home. And the Lord grant you, verse 9, that you may rest, find rest, and each in the house of her husband. In other words, I hope you will remarry and find a life again. And they said to her, surely we will return with you to your people. Well, you can imagine how uncomfortable it would be to let an elderly widow travel all by herself. Here you're the two daughters-in-law. You may be pulled back a little bit, but you want to support your mother-in-law. So both of them initially said, no, we're going with you. But Naomi said, turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Are there still sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? You know, your life is going to be very limited if you come with me. The opportunities are back there in Moab with your people, with your family. Turn back, my daughters, verse 12. For I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, if I should have a husband tonight and should bear sons, would you wait for them till they were grown?" She said, "Look, it's a hopeless situation. Even if I could have children and have them tonight, would you be able to wait that long until they're grown and have husbands?" You know, how unlike the culture of today, where a husband was an important factor, something women actually desired. I don't want to get started there, but it is things are changing so rapidly. Verse 13, "Would you wait for them until they are grown? Would you restrain yourselves from having husbands? No, my daughters, for it grieves me very much for your sakes that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." So she's feeling a little bit of remorse and pain and starting to accuse God just a little bit. As we all wonder about why would God put this upon us? How could this happen to me? No one ever runs up and embraces change and hugs it. "Oh, I've been waiting my whole life for this." And what a difficult trial this must have been for Naomi. "Then they lifted up their voices and wept again." All three of them. Of course, they're women. They're going to cry, sure. And we men do that once in a while too. So they're all three crying. And Orpah, that's Orpah, not Oprah, Orpah kissed her mother-in-law and said goodbye. She went back. Anything wrong with that? No, I won't condemn Orpah for that, but I will commend Ruth for what she did. Ruth clung to Naomi. Now, verse 15, she said, "Look, your sister-in-law," Naomi speaking here, "has gone back to her people and to her gods, her culture, her way of life. Return after your sister-in-law." Now, the words of Ruth. Is there any more beautiful verbiage in the Scripture than this? This level of commitment, absolutely phenomenal. Listen to these words. Ruth said to Naomi, "Entreat me," or "don't ask me," you know, "entreat me not, do not ask me to leave you or to turn back from following after you." And of course, for generations, these words have been used to describe the commitment, dedication, devotion, and conversion necessary for a Christian to have toward Jesus Christ. Now listen again to Ruth. "Entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you. For wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people. Your God shall be my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried." Now, is there any more complete commitment and devotion than you could name or describe than this? "Where you go, I go. Where you sleep, I sleep. Where you live, I live. Where you die, I die. Where you're buried, I bury." And to cap it off, she takes an oath. "The Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts you and me." Now that's commitment. Now Ruth had lost her husband. Ruth was turning her back on everything and she was going to a strange new land and the options for fulfilling her life and hopes and dreams were limited from her vantage point at that time in her life, but we all know the story. We all know the story. Now, you talk about embracing change, putting the self in a secondary position, and making the kind of commitment that is unshakable and not agreeing to fall prey to any of the temptations to say, well, maybe I should, and Naomi will be all right. No, I'm making this commitment. It is ironclad, and I'm moving forward. I'm leaving my life behind. I'm giving my life for Naomi. This is what I want to do, and the Lord do so, and more to me, if anything but death separates us. What a beautiful story. Now, you all know how it ends, but I want you to turn to Matthew 1, verse 5. Matthew 1, verse 5. You know, none of us get to choose our descendants, but God chose the descendants of Jesus Christ. Notice here in verse 5. I wonder how he pronounced his name. You think it was Salmon? I don't know. Salmon begot Boaz by Rahab. Now Matthew doesn't say the harlot, but that's what she was for a living. Obviously, she turned her life around. We all know that she was instrumental in offering Israel a way into the promised land. Notice, Boaz begot Obed by Ruth. And you recall, several weeks ago, I mentioned in our discussion of knowing Christ from the Old Testament and reviewing Matthew's genealogy that there were only three women mentioned in this genealogy. And they were apparently all Gentiles. Bathsheba, Ruth, and Rahab, the three of them. Now, if you ever wanted someone with commitment and devotion and dedication in your family tree, could you pick anybody better than Ruth? And all of these were choices and decisions. Everything that God did, He did with a purpose and for a reason. It is a remarkable thing to consider that God knew exactly what He was doing in Ruth's life. And you all know the story of the shoe and how Boaz finally got connected with the family and finally claimed his right, finally married Ruth. It's a very happy story with a very happy ending, but the tremendous level of commitment here to Ruth and of Ruth is certainly something to behold. And what a marvelous tribute to her that she is in the genealogy of Jesus Christ. What a remarkable person she must have been to put herself in a secondary position. Truly, she diminished herself down to really nothing and hooked herself to Naomi's sled and took off, not knowing what lied ahead. Could you do that? I know I couldn't. I know I couldn't. Very difficult. Check out her reaction to change. Where you go, I go. Where you go, I'm not going, not on your life. I don't want to go there. I don't want to be there. I don't want to do that. My life's here. You have your life. I have my life. That was before the internet, when you could have your own life and choose everything in your life. As long as you have a credit card and the internet, you can have your own life and do exactly what you want to do. You don't care about anybody else. That's the way it seems sometimes, isn't it? We are so disconnected from other people and so connected by social networking and credit cards and purchases online and all of the custom things that we can accrue to ourselves, that human connection really isn't there as strongly as it was over the years and as it was here with Ruth and Naomi. So when change comes into your life, check out Ruth. Check out Ruth. Third example, Genesis 45. One of my favorite stories in all of the Old Testament, Joseph. You talk about change. As a young man, he was his father's favorite son. And to honor him, what did he get? A coat of many colors. Mr. Rainbow. And, of course, this went over really well with the other brothers, right? Favoritism is never a good idea, parents. It usually backfires and creates problems. So Joseph sports his coat out into the field at his father's request to check on his brothers. They were out there herding or doing whatever. And he walks up. Of course, you can see him a mile away because he's got this wild coat of many colors on. You know, here comes that dreamer again. And not only the coat made it difficult, but the dreams he had. You know, I dreamt that there were shocks of grain in the field, and you guys were all the shocks of grain. My shock of grain was the biggest, and you all bowed down to me. Well, the brothers loved to hear that. Tell us another dream, Joseph. Of course, they resented him. They hated him. They were disgusted with him. And here's the real capper. He had another dream where the sun, the moon, and all the stars bowed down to him. In other words, his father and mother and all of his brothers. Well, that was it. That was it. So he came strutting in. He was probably not the most discerning person as far as what to say and what not to say. Just came out. And of course, he was a man with a vision and a dream. So he talked about his dreams. Now, we all know the dream came true. But how did it come true? Not without a lot of change. So he goes from Rainbow Boy to a kid stripped of his rainbow coat and thrown into a pit. They were going to leave him to die, but Judah said, let's make some money on him. So they pulled him out and sold him to a group of, what was it, Amalekite slave traders? And then they dipped that multicolored coat in animal blood and took it back to his father and said, we don't exactly know what happened, but we found this coat and there's blood on it. It looks suspicious. Of course, they couldn't run any DNA tests, so Jacob thought that his favorite son was dead. He wasn't. He was a slave in Egypt, but somebody bought him, Potiphar. So he went from color coat, favorite son, right, to dead boy in the pit, to slave in a foreign country, and then he rose to be the manager of Potiphar's house. Now, you don't do that walking around with your head down mumbling. It's not fair, this change. Right? So Potiphar, he knew nothing was going. He gave the whole house over to him. But now we have Potiphar's wife. She likes Joseph. She tries to tempt him. Joseph made the mistake of being in the house alone with her. She grabs his garment. He runs out of it. She's got his coat. She screams, rape. Potiphar believes his lying wife. Where's Joseph? Back in the hole again. What a life. Up, down. How long was he in prison? What, 7 years or more? Of course, what happened in prison? His dream kept him alive, right? His dream kept him alive. What happened in prison? Well, he became the quasi-warden. He was over all the prisoners. He was walking around saying, why are you so sad today? What? Yeah, how things going? Could you do that in prison? And finally, by a circuitous series of events, he was brought before Pharaoh to interpret a dream. So he's finally out of prison. So it looks like he's coming up again. And, of course, all of Pharaoh's wizards and wise men couldn't interpret his dream. Joseph gave credit to God. Joseph interpreted the dream, and Joseph told Pharaoh what he should do to prepare for the 7 lean cows, or the 7 lean years. And what do you think possessed Pharaoh to make the statement he made? When he said, look, how would we ever find anybody who could do this job that this young man has described better than him? So he called Joseph forward, gave him his ring, his signet, gave him his robe. He was Pharaoh in everything, really, except for the title. He ran the show. So look, what do you like your graph to look like? Boom, 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 boom. Right? Then we get to the kingdom and all is well. Well, Joseph was like a roller coaster ride every day. And do you think, why didn't Joseph say, well, you know, Pharaoh, I'll tell you what your dream means if you'll get me out of that stinking dungeon that I'm in for false reasons. And I'm not going to tell you anything. You hear any of that from Joseph? No. No, you just hear the complete description of the dream, what it meant, what the Pharaoh should do, and suddenly Joseph is the Pharaoh. Now, what happens after that? Well, the famine spreads. After the 7 years of plenty, the famine spreads. People of surrounding countries, up in the land of Israel, in fact, are struggling. There is very little food. So who comes to the grocery store in Egypt but his brothers, right? They come for some food. So what would most of us do? Oh boy, I'm the Pharaoh and now my brothers have come and now I'm going to be... I remember what they did. I have never forgotten it. Was that Joseph's reaction? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. No vengeance, no revenge. I want you to read just one little verse here before we conclude. Chapter 45, verse 7, when he finally reveals himself to his brothers. And he's weeping. Especially when he embraced little Benjamin. And he toyed with them a little bit, didn't he? He sent them back and he hid his chalice in their bag and called them back and said, you stole this. Well, I'm going to hold this brother until you bring your father. And so he devised a way to finally get his whole family there. And finally, when he couldn't take it anymore, and I wonder if he had a big surprise event planned when he was going to bring his whole family in and reveal himself at that point, but he just couldn't go on. And he revealed himself to his brothers. He was in a banquet room. He sent all of his servants out. He said, I am Joseph. I'll bet you they ran for the corner and started cowering. Look what he said. Verse 7. God sent me before you to preserve a posterity for you in the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. Now, even more telling, verse 8. So now it was not you who sent me here. What would all of us have thought? Rotten brothers. Right? It was not you who sent me here. God did it. God did it. Oh. How could he react to that kind of dramatic change in his life and forget all of the human reaction and say, don't blame yourself. This is God's doing. And he didn't say that in an accusatory way. God made this mess. You didn't. Right? No, God brought this all about for a higher purpose and a greater reason. And isn't that what life is all about? No matter where you are, up or down, isn't it all about a higher purpose and a greater reason? Isn't that what Christ was talking about when he referred to John the Baptist, even being the greatest of all prophets? even the least of those in the kingdom would be greater than John. You see, the outcome is so much greater than we can imagine. And Joseph caught that vision. And he didn't let any change in his physical life affect his relationship with God or his relationship with his family, who frankly didn't treat him very well. He has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt. And if you and I were Joseph, we might want to rub it in a little and say, you guys remember those dreams I had? Well, look at me now. That wasn't his attitude at all. So from favorite son to slave to overseer to prisoner to Pharaoh and beyond. Joseph had a dream, a vision for his future, and a relationship with God that he never allowed to be compromised, no matter what the change. So through these examples and looking at our personal lives and the challenges we face from time to time, I hope that we can, as I mentioned in the introduction, expect change, grow through change, and accept it. And if we can follow the examples of these three individuals that we looked at today, for even though John the Baptist was a little shaky, he was the greatest prophet ever, and certainly under adverse circumstances, conducted himself admirably. And then you have Ruth, and you have Joseph, and of course there are many others. So let's expect change, let's grow through it, and let's accept the reality of change being a part of our lives.